I'm Tammy Vindon, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome Heidi Prowse. She's the CEO of Mental Illness Education ACT and the co-founder of the Santa Speedo Shuffle for Cystic Fibrosis. Today, we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running a charity. Heidi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were actually introduced from by Laura, who's my digital content developer. So she does all the social media stuff for me.
Yes.
And she said, you have to talk to Heidi.
Uh-oh.
I think she met you in one of her other jobs. But the interesting thing was that the day that you accepted my invitation to be on this show, I was asked by a friend who had COVID to take her spot in a gala ball. I didn't even know what it was for. I had 2 hours notice. And I literally said, yes, showed up, and there you were.
Hi.
So that was fantastic. And I do want to talk about that ball specifically because there's some really interesting things that go against every fundraising rule that you hear about.
Yes.
And so that will be very interesting to go into the why and the how and everything behind that. But first of all, for those that are not familiar with your organization, can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, of course. So it's Mental Illness Education ACT, or MEACT, and it's an organization that has been based in the capital of Australia, in Canberra, for 30 years.
Wow.
And I would say that it has a really common interest in the way that it was established. It was started by a parent who had a child that was living with schizophrenia. And a sibling went to school and just experienced some really challenging bullying. And what I love about this story was the response was not, you know, this bullying is not okay. The response was, if we educate, the response could be different. And so that parent got together with a bunch of other parents that had children and young people with mental illness in Canberra. And they set up a way to go into schools initially to talk about mental illness and to talk about what it looks like and what it is, and to really challenge the perception that the community have around mental illness. And it has grown and grown over the years as the conversation about mental health has evolved. And, you know, if you think 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, that conversation in your own life around what mental health has looked like. And so now we're an organization that is much bigger. We have around about 37 staff, which includes around 20 casual instructors who are delivering programs. And we deliver programs from the age of 8 to 108.
Wow.
And it's at the moment it is very focused on the Canberra community and looking at leading with lived experience. So it's leading with people who have been there, who know, but who can focus on the hopeful outcome, who can focus on the part of their journey that is not what happened to me, but what I did. And understanding that journey so that you as a listener or you as someone who hears that story can see maybe some of your own similarities with it or similar experiences. Or you may look through the window and better understand and build empathy about mental health. And then what I love is that then the evidence base backs it up. And for me, I feel my whole career that I have been where I've needed to be. And when I came into this organization, I loved that it led with the practical and then backed with the research, because that makes sense to me. It's how I piece things together. I'm a doer. So I really loved to hear the story and then be able to go, okay, so what does this mean? And then how do I make sense of it? And that's what we're seeing particularly in the mental health space is, again, it's not about what is happening to me, but it is what are my options to move forward, through, or to cope with where I am right now.
Mm. I have a number of questions, and I'd like to go back just a little bit. In the context of your programs, how do you define mental health?
Good question. So I think the reality is that there's a number of variations of mental health. So as a community, we still have quite a bit of stigma and we get a little bit concerned about which word we use to define. If I was to look at it, I would say mental health is like physical health. It is a fitness overall that everybody experiences focused on our mind. When I look at mental ill health, it's like having a cold. It's a moment in time where the load becomes heavier than we're used to. And at that point, we need to seek additional support. And it's something that we can move through either way. And then mental illness is the persistent diagnosed mental illness condition that means that we have a lifelong journey of keeping well. And I think to make most sense of it, when we talk about physical health, it's really easy, isn't it? We say physical health, we should go to the gym every day. So mental health is the same. We should be doing something for our minds every day. When we have a cold, there are things that we do, like we stop and we pull back and we take care of ourselves. And, you know, mental ill health is exactly the same. And then a chronic illness means that there are long-term activities that we need to do to take care of ourselves. So I think that's the really important element for people is to think about it in that way. And our program that we deliver in high schools does just that. It says, you know, if you had a cold, you have a plan that you would take action. And you do that so comfortably. But when we think about our mental health, fear sets in. And that's what our organization does every day, is challenges that fear because it is just a part of who we are.
And does your organization support people through that entire spectrum of mental health?
Yeah, so we have a lived experience volunteer group who are the core of our organization. They share their stories of mental illness, but it allows us to talk about the entire trajectory of well-being. It allows us to talk about very early experiences of emotion and coping. And we're just about to start rolling out a primary school program, which, you know, you'd think, oh, we couldn't possibly talk to 8-year-olds about mental health. And it's like, well, we need to start building their awareness of their emotions. We need to start building their coping strategies. These are the types of things that will be with them for their entire life. They are things that they will pull out of their back pocket whenever they need them. So we start that conversation really early. And then we continue to have that conversation throughout life because, let's be honest, it's probably been something that everyone's been reminded to, maybe you should go to the gym or we should maybe eat better. So all of those things we do. But even though we all know, we don't necessarily actively do all the time. So that's been an incredible thing for me, I think, is seeing that very early conversation, the conversation about this is what I'm experiencing, I need to do something. But then also the hope emphasis, which is it may take some time to work out the thing that really works for you, but there is something. There absolutely is something. It's just finding that thing. And it's a shame that you can't just go, oh, you're purple, here's the purple solution. Mm. Because it does take time and it does take a lot of courage to continue to work on those things and find those things and respond when you get a setback. But I think the having someone standing in front of you who's been on that entire journey and they go, I'm here. And it's okay.
Let's talk about operationally how you deliver that, because I see a very unique model here in the sense that you have people that have experienced the same issues or health issues are now the trainers. Yeah. And I'm speaking with some of our other guests who have been in the community sector. It's not unusual for those individuals to also suffer through these processes of helping someone else. Mm-hmm. So from an operational point of view, how do you support those individuals knowing that they're already those that might be more vulnerable to mental health conditions and now they're trying to help others? How do you support them?
Great question. And the absolute foundation of MEACT is our Do No Harm framework. So Do No Harm is something that, again, we created as a lived experience co-design model for how do we protect ourselves when we share our stories. But secondly, how do we consider the audience that we're communicating to and ensure that they are safe? Because what we know is when we have conversations that are very challenging and make us feel not okay, our brain goes into survival mode. Mm-hmm. Our brain has no capacity to continue to listen. So we don't want to go into a classroom of year seven students and nudge. We want to go in and say, this is a safe space and we're going to talk about some stuff today. But the do no harm principles allow you to structure the conversation so that you educate and so that those minds can fully listen to the whole story. So there are six principles, and I won't go into all of them, but feel free to, you know, Google MIEACT.org.au and you can find out more about our Do No Harm program. But some of the considerations are, for example, our language. So the language that we use does not go into method and detail. We don't actually need to talk about, say, a trauma event. We can simply say, I experienced abuse, but I don't need to tell you what that abuse was, because that doesn't mean anything when it comes to education. It is, this was the thing that I faced, but actually what I want to focus on is what I did next. And that is incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And the main principle of Do No Harm is context and purpose. And I think this is a really important lesson for anybody who shares their story in any environment, is what are you actually trying to achieve when you share your story? Because if the purpose is you want a person to feel the way that you did, really challenge yourself to consider if that's an okay purpose. If you want them to understand, you don't need to go into the details. And one of the things I've found, particularly about, you know, sharing my own personal journey, is analogies actually work a lot better than providing someone with details because they really won't understand. So every session that we walk into, we think about who is the audience, what are we trying to achieve, and our focus must always be on education. And then the sixth principle is self-care. And so it's about recognizing that sometimes you might end up in a situation that was not what you expected. So how do you prepare yourself before? What are your responses within a session? And then what do you do after? And the very first time I shared my story at MEACT, I took the afternoon off. And I thought, oh, you know, why? Why would I do this? But it was heavy at the end of the day. And I had to think, I can't just dive back in and keep working. So self-care is quite a fascinating principle to include, but it also allows us to say to all of our volunteers, you need to be accountable. And the big one is you also don't have to show up. I mean, I completely respect every human being. You know what you can and you can't do, but you shouldn't share your story on a bad day. And that's okay.
So it's one thing to say that that's possible. We know how challenging it is when suddenly you have to cancel events with schools, perhaps. Yep. The other thing is to hold people accountable for themselves is nice in theory and in training, but not necessarily always possible in practice. Do you have external or internal support for those individuals?
Yeah, we have a whole range of things that we've put in place. So when I first joined MEACT cancelling was a regular occurrence, but we had worked with schools for so long that there was a very strong relationship, trust, and understanding around the reasons for that. So what we ended up doing was bringing in a contingency, which was if we had a cancellation, then we would bring in a paid educator who would use a video, a digital story of the experience, and then they would run the additional content. So that might be partnered with one lived experience presenter, or it could be, you know, just, you know, that two people that are showing videos. But every person has mental health. So what we find is direct positive contact goes into the room, and I could say, you know, I am, you know, living with a mental health challenge at the moment, but I'm not okay to share my story today. So what I'd like to do is actually show a video. And for some of our volunteers, they'd show their own video. And we would sit there and think, you know, does that change the outcome? The first volunteer who did that got a standing ovation at the end of their session.
Wow.
And I think there was so much respect because immediately they said, I'm not really okay to share it myself today. I'd like to play my video for you instead. Mm. And it just allowed you immediately to go, why don't I think about these things? And I love that it actually challenged me as a CEO of an organization to go, why are we so focused on chasing numbers, chasing targets, delivering, you know, money. And MEACT has been a phenomenal organization for me to go, I get better outcomes by not chasing those things. Because how can I push and then try to walk out and go, well, we've educated people about mental health, but my entire workforce is burnt out. So it's been, you know, it's not something that I worked out overnight. I've been at MEACT for 4.5 years, and it's something that I'm continuing to learn and open to continuous improvement, but utilizing little strategies around, okay, let's give all of our volunteers a digital version of their story so they have that in their back pocket if they need to use it. Let's have a workforce that can support, so can come in. And what I started to see was volunteers felt like they couldn't cancel, and they'd cancel last minute. And I thought, we're not taking care of our people. What we see now is they know 3-4 days before, I know that I'm not going to be ready for that session. They know in themselves, but they trust us and we're taking care of them. So they let us know early enough, and generally we can shift our schedule and bring someone else in. And I think that's the moments that we need to think about. And I've often talked about, we talk about mental health within a workplace setting. At one point, 100% of our workplace was living with or caring for someone with a mental illness. This isn't something that we can get wrong. So I think it's about being creative and really considering what you can do to support your workforce and challenging the status quo.
Well, I think that's an excellent solution for any organization that is used to delivering things in person.
Yeah.
You know, because even with COVID, the number of times that things have been canceled because of that, in totally different contexts, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's some really good lessons learned for any not-for-profit about looking creatively in the way that you might deliver in-person presentation if required. I know we had talked to Francis from Culture Break, and he had luckily had moved into more of a virtual training program before COVID hit,
yes,
which saved them financially too. So operationally, that makes a lot of sense just from your own mission and your internal staffing, knowing what they're capable of. So brilliant lesson learned there. How did you get involved in the community sector yourself?
Completely fell. So I have always been someone who is very practically focused. So I have not had the same traditional sort of education pathway. I went straight into the workforce when I finished high school, and then I went on to do an accelerated business marketing course. The reason I chose that course was it had a 6-month internship, so I could get out of the books and straight into learning. That's where I do my best learning, is on the job. So at 20, I was told to apply for everything, so I did. I just basically searched jobs, events, because that was really the area that I wanted to work in. And I got an interview with Camp Quality. And the role was far greater than anything else that I was applying for admin jobs, and it was a coordinator role. And I went to this interview and they walked the business card across the table. It's a finger puppet. And I'm like, oh no, I really want this job now. And they took a bet on me, a bit of a gamble on me, because there were three in the final stage. I had no experience. The second candidate had 5 years experience, and the third candidate had 8 years experience. And when they said to me, you know, what is your development area? I said, well, I've never done this job before, but I'm ready to grow with the organization and I'm really keen to just learn as much as I possibly can. And luckily that got me the job. And it's funny actually now today, that lady who made that call is now my mentor 15 years later. And we've done this full circle, but I guess it's her fault because I came into the community sector. It wasn't what I was looking at. I didn't know anything about it. But as soon as I got in, I thought, oh, I've found my purpose. I've found the place that gets me out of bed every morning and makes me just want to learn. And I was lucky enough to be given opportunities, you know, quite early on. I was in a senior manager or middle management role by 24. And that again was, you know, the organization listening to me and being willing to work with me and actually to be honest with me, because I said, you need to tell me all the things that I'm not doing right, because I want to be amazing. I want to be great. So you need to tell me how to be better. And being, I think, open to continuous learning has made a big difference. But it also, I think, changes the way that I approach work. And I've worked with lots of different people over the years, and I always hear, I don't know that, or I can't do that. And I'm like, I'll give it a go. Like, I'll Google, I'll use a network. I will call people who I think might know to give me guidance, and I will throw myself in, because what's the worst that could happen? I'll learn from this experience. And I think that that approach has meant that I've gotten into the role that I am in now. And I had an ambitious goal to be CEO by 30, and I think I was 30 and a half.
Pretty ambitious.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Did you go right from Camp Quality to MIAT?
No, so I was at Camp Quality, and then they sent me actually on a secondment, and I came to Canberra and met my husband in a month of moving here and didn't want to leave. So I tried the public service for 12 months in one day. It was a little bit slow for me. And then he was living with cystic fibrosis, and a job came up with that organization. And I'd have to say it's the worst interview I've ever done, because I told them all the reasons they shouldn't employ me, because I wanted them to have the best person. So I was like, these are the things that I can't do, because if the other candidate's better, you should choose them. I just wanted the best for the organization. And when I got into that role, it was no slowing me down. I had passion, purpose, and an opportunity to build a community. And the only reason I did resign from that role is Andy got listed for a double lung transplant, and we had to relocate to Sydney for a few months. And once again, you know, the organization came before me. So I, you know, put my resignation to say, you need someone to come in that can keep, you know, things going on. And Andy and I have both sort of continued a volunteer and support role to that organization. But at the same time, it gave me the opportunity to land at MEACT. And that was just, Andy's got a call for a transplant 26 days after he was listed. And we'd thought it would take a lot longer. And then I went, I need a job. I need to go back to something. There were two jobs available at the time that were sort of in the area that I work. And luckily I got one of them. And yeah, the rest is history, really.
Was that the CEO role to begin with?
So it was actually an executive officer role. So basically the difference between a CEO and executive officer is an executive officer reports to a management committee. So the organization was going through quite a bit of a change and a learning opportunity. So the management committee have operational delegation. But over the time, sort of was in about 18 months to 2 years within the role, they promoted me into the CEO, and then that management committee became a board. So then their focus is on governance and on strategy. So that was really fantastic to actually go through that process with the board, go through that learning and lifting them up, as well as me moving into a more significant role within the organization, and that particularly that decision making and culture leading. And it was interesting because, again, it was because I have always had really open conversations with the people I report to about what I want to do and that I do want to be better. I always want to be better. And I said, my next role will be a CEO role. And they said, well, why can't this one be a CEO role? Let's make this work. So I feel like, a lot of the time we're fearful of having those conversations. And I've always felt that at the moment I don't have it. So if I ask for it and I don't get it, then I'm still at the same level. But if I ask and I get it, then woohoo, here we are.
It shows you what bravery can do with these conversations,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think the opposite to bravery is thinking that failure is a problem. And I think failure is the best thing that you can experience. So it's just that perception and reframing what that word means to you. Because it is certainly hard to not get what you want. but I think it's about really thinking it's always about moving forward. You never move backwards.
I can't help but think that your fundraising background is probably one of the best skills to have as a CEO. And more organizations would benefit if they can bring in someone with a sales or a fundraising background. Let's talk about the gala, because that was interesting. That was my first gala ball, and Canberra has one probably every weekend.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to get dressed up every weekend, I could do this and attend a charity ball. This one was the first one I've ever been to that was a non-alcoholic event.
Yes.
Which goes against all the rules of fundraising, which is when you do these balls, you're supposed to get people stinking drunk. That's the rule.
Yeah.
So that they open their wallets and donate more.
Yeah.
Tell me what your thinking was and how that worked for you.
So the very first thing is I hate gala balls. I hate them, and I use that word very purposefully because I don't really hate anything. I don't like to run fundraisers that are not focused on fundraising. I really believe that an organization has a purpose and a cause and values, and that should always be prioritized in any fundraising activity. So there's a few things that really don't sit well with me when it comes to galas, in the sense of, really kind of promoting people about supporting you, which I feel is a bit ego-driven. And the other part is, creating this environment where essentially hoping that people will drink too much and then they will give because of that reason, not because your cause is not worthy. So my board actually, for the entire time that I've been at MEAC, have been asking me to do a ball, and I just kept diverting. Went, oh, look over here, let's talk about this thing, or let's try these revenue streams first and let's go down this path. And we got to the beginning of this year and I got asked again, and I thought, okay, happy to do it, but it has to be a Heidi gala, and it has to be a MEACT gala. So MEACT actually have a no alcohol policy as an organization. So none of our events have alcohol. So how could we then run a gala that did? And I thought, this is actually a really important element, because my entire career has been focused on the hard and the nudging and, putting a sick child in front of you that will make you make a donation. And I remember when I was interviewed for my job at MEACT, was I really look forward to learning more about this do no harm, because you are challenging everything I've ever believed is the way to get an outcome. And so what I saw was an opportunity to create a model of empowerment that gets people involved and connected into a community. And I feel like every person that left that night didn't just go through a revolving door and will go, that was just another gala that I went to. They're so connected to our community, so connected to what we do, and actually feel a part of it. So the alcohol was one part, which was, this is a no-brainer. Like, we cannot have alcohol there. And I actually had so many people tell me, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. You even have to give people the option when they come in about whether they drink or not. And I went, no, if they want to drink, this is not the event for them. We have a no alcohol policy. You know who's more important than the guest that pays their ticket is the volunteer who needs to sit at a table or participate in this event where alcohol has been an unhealthy part of their journey. So that person is more important to me, even though they might not necessarily purchase their ticket. I might say, I want you to come. I want you to be here because you're a part of my community. You're the person I'm prioritizing. And I think that part was really important. There was also a lot that happened behind the scenes, and we had a room that was separated from the gala that all of our volunteers knew that if the evening became overwhelming or was too much, that they could go and have a space to just have a break and have some quiet time. And even before the event, I had some volunteers who came with me to the venue, and I walked them through the venue and I showed them the space that we were going to be, and we went through the run sheet. Now, these are all things that you would never do, but it made all the difference on the night. And the other significant difference was we had no auctions and we had no raffles. And that's the other thing is, you know, you come to a gala and these are all the things that you have. And for me, again, I felt like I have someone who's going to share their story. And that's what MEAC do. I mean, we're really putting ourselves on show tonight to see exactly what we do in the community. And then I'm going to put an item up that maybe two or three people in this room actually have the capacity to buy. And also they get something back. So again, that I even wanted to challenge that concept. And I said, I just want you to make a donation. But we had, you know, organizations donating $10,000 and individuals donating $30,000, and you felt the same. But it was as a collective community empowering to be a part of making a difference together. So for me, it really is about challenging the status quo. Why does a gala have to be this way? Is there really evidence around getting people drunk will make more money? We walked away with a 60% profit margin. And tell me any other fundraising event that has ever done that before, particularly a gala event.
Mm. I would absolutely agree with you. I went back and looked at some previous statistics for gala balls with organizations I'd worked with, and I saw a 10% profit margin after they had the best party in town.
Yeah.
And I was really appalled by that. Can we work through that a little bit? Because there might be people listening that are like, I would love to throw an event like this. Tell me how it works. Now, you did have – luckily I was in the room, so I had a great opportunity to see this. Did you have these people lined up already to give donations?
I had enough to get the room moving. So that's the other thing that I like is, you know, I guess being a career fundraiser is I could pull all the bits that I like most about fundraising and – almost mash them into one event, which meant that my board got their gala, but I got what I wanted, which was raising money. So the way that I did it was we didn't have corporate sponsors either. So I knew that there were organizations that I wanted to get into the room. So, and we also had a quite significant singer, an Australian artist, Kate Miller-Heidke, who was our headliner. And we had some promotional barriers around we couldn't actually advertise the event because of promotional restrictions. So we did an exclusive invite. So I sent messages to people, I sent emails to individuals, and I said, I would like to personally invite you to come to this event. And a lot of people were like, without me even telling them what it was, yes, we are there. Put me down for a table. And so I actually think that exclusive invitation really made a difference. And I've seen since the gala that we've had an increase in actually the general public that have seen this gala happen and went, how do I get on this list for next year? So I've really loved that way too much. So it was sort of starting with that. And then once the person booked their table, I then said, let's have a coffee. I just want to let you know that it's a little bit different to what you've usually been to. And I would sit down and go through our donor care program. So it was basically saying, this isn't just about one night, but this is about supporting something that's so important to our community. And currently our 8, 9, and 10-year-olds in Canberra don't have access to a really strong evidence-based mental health program. And that's really important. So it allowed me to open the conversation around some larger donations. And so I sort of had around about 50% of donations lined up before we got there. Of what we got, but actually that was more than what I had planned to make on the night. So that was great because myself and our main speaker, you know, I could just say, we've already made more than what I was planning. Woohoo, successful event, let's just enjoy ourselves. And then so we had people that were ready to donate on the night, and I also had put my volunteers throughout the room and they had little slips so they would get up and say, I'm going to make a donation. And the main reason we had to do that was no one's been in a room like this before. They wouldn't have got it. So you needed to create the environment, whereas I feel next year we wouldn't have to do as much of this because people are going to be ready, or at least half the room's going to be ready, because hopefully there's double next year. but once it started, it just kept going, and the money kept going up and up and up, and we had people standing up and saying, I want to donate this amount, and there was some beautiful competition between organizations to have the biggest amount. But also there was a lot of silent donations. I mean, I don't think that there was anyone in that room that didn't make a donation on that night. And so they still were acknowledged. They didn't have to stand up and say that this was the amount that they were going to give, because they did it with their actions. So we could all really celebrate that together. The other two things that I think are really key about that event are we had a very simple amount. So it was $30, one child gets to go to this program. Simple, easy, accessible. You can't underestimate the power of that. And then the other thing is, you know, my entire fundraising career, you know, you kind of talk to someone about coming and speaking at an event and then you're like, we'll just see what we get. So Millie, who was our guest speaker, and myself, we actually did training together. We prepared her, she wrote her speech and we went through it, and we really made sure that it hit very specific fundraising recommendations within the speech that she made. And then my speech as the MC actually really linked all of those key messages. So I think that's an important thing to think about, is a lot of the time we get worried about, oh, I can't like tell you how to tell your story. But Millie had already, she's one of our volunteers. She shares her story for the last 6 months in school. So she had a really strong story, and I could say to her, okay, let's go back to do no harm, context and purpose. What are we trying to achieve? So we're not necessarily focused on education. We're focused on moving a group of people who have no idea who we are to give at least $30. So we had very specific key messages that we wanted to make sure that we got across, and then I was able to reinforce them. So it's great to kind of think about, you know, we didn't just pull off this random thing that just was like, whoa, here we go, have a gala and let's not give people alcohol and we'll just get someone to talk and then we're going to do this pledge. Every single component was so strategic. Every element was really focusing on in creating an experience of empowerment. Even the branding was all considered in that entire approach, and that is why it was successful. And even our volunteers were all on the journey with us. So, yeah, it's not just sort of going, we'll just run a ball the same old way and we won't have alcohol. We thought, all right, the pitch is the most important thing. So we can't just stand up and say a story from the heart. We still are saying a story from the heart, but we've got to really think about the way that we communicate that message.
It was incredibly memorable for me. For someone who's been to a lot of these things, I found it that it stayed with me. And that $30 pitch, you know, we heard people in the room say, I'm going to to buy enough for an entire classroom for my kids, to take care of everybody in that class, or I'm going to look after my two nephews, or pretty much everyone had someone they can say, I want to look after their cost for that day, because $30 was so achievable and easy, even for someone on a budget. I really love that. And I loved how you just shared how you worked with your speaker, because her sharing the story was quite important. But it was also weird to go home so early and and not have anything to drink. It was just such an odd
drive home.
It was such a different experience.
Hello, Saturday morning.
I love that. I loved everything about that. And thank you for sharing how you actually did. I think some other people who are listening to this could really benefit from that experience. I want to make sure that we also talk about two other things. First of all, you've won a golden hoodie for being a Salesforce trailblazer. So we've just gone through this whole process of talking about community service, and yet you're some sort of tech whiz behind the scenes.
Just for fun.
Yeah, tell us how this happens, because it sounds like you also have a small business in this space too.
Yeah, so I guess, again, like, it's falling into things, but also my real interest in learning on the job. So I know that there would be so many people out there who have just been handed the, you need to implement a CRM. Mm-hmm. A new database system for your organization. And you generally have no skills or understanding about that thing. You just happen to be the one that gets it landed. So I was in a role where I did get handed that particular project, and this was when I was working for the National Museum of Australia. And what was great at that time was there was actually an entire IT department, and there were people that were specialists in IT that I just sat with and listened to. But the product, which I will not name, was horrible. And I think the big thing about why I struggled with it was because I was reliant on somebody else making it better. And that really was hard. But with such a big organization, we had the capability to invest in the person who would make it better. And I moved into my next role, which was with cystic fibrosis, and I needed a database. And the decision had already been made by a national federation while I was a staff member by myself. A part of this entire federation was, we're going to move to the Salesforce platform. And I had no idea what Salesforce was, but I put in a grant application with our local government. And because I just had this really hard time trying to implement something and not really getting it, I included in my grant application for me to do administration training in this program. So the platform, because I just thought, I can't just do this blindly. I have to understand the system. So I was lucky enough to get that grant, and it actually wasn't, you know, it was about $15,000. So it wasn't a huge grant. But what it did was it sent me to Sydney for 2 weeks. Over about a month, and I did the basically administration training for Salesforce and then the advanced level. And then my brain hurt a lot because I really had not considered what I got myself into. And I absolutely do not recommend doing both of those trainings so close together, particularly when I'd never even logged into the system before doing the training. But what it did tell me was, this is the platform and this is everything that you can do with it. And the best thing about Salesforce is you can do everything, but should you? So I just started to sort of learn the platform, and then there was this incredible moment where I realized I could be better at my job if I used this system. And I think the thing that I've never been trained in, but I just am naturally capable of, is unpacking process puzzles and implementing systems. And I've always thought it's because I'm lazy, but I think I just like to get to a place quickly and I see patterns and I'm able to then build processes. So what that looked like was, I had an organization where I was delivering services, and I started to see patterns. For example, we would provide a vitamin supplement to people with cystic fibrosis, and it's a very special supplement that is particularly made for a person with CF. And I realized that, you know, this is how many you take every day. And then I would get a call from someone going, I just took the last one. I need, and I'm like, we're not an emergency organization. Like this process could be better. So what I did is I built into the system a workflow that just allowed me to, when the first order came in, it identified which dose they were on, and then it sent them a reminder, you should be almost finished of the pack that we've sent you. Please fill out the form and we'll repost another one. And that's just one example of an entire organization that I completely automated. But I really personalized the language. So what I found was my community were like, oh, Heidi's sitting up at 9 o'clock sending me emails and I was asleep. But I made the system work for me. And I was one person. But the amount of productivity that I was able to achieve as one person was really phenomenal because I could just come in at the points that I needed to and action. And that, I think, really changed my understanding of business. It really changed the way that I was thinking about what I was doing. I kind of realized that I'd always been doing little things. So I did some training in Outlook. And if you've never done training in Outlook, you need to do training in Outlook because that system is actually phenomenal and it does a lot of stuff for you. And if you send the same email on a regular basis, it can do it for you. So, you know, I sort of noticed that I had been doing these things in these roles that I'd been in, but Salesforce was just a whole nother place that I could change the operating environment, the engagement with the community. And that gave me time to spend on the things that I felt were more important, which was actually on the relationships, which was actually on learning and understanding the community need and to fundraise, you know, to be in a space where we could, you know, make more revenue for the organization. And I think the first day I started at MEACT, we had a Word document with our entire, you know, schedule on it. And they had just implemented a new website and a database, not on the Salesforce platform. And I thought, oh, they've just done this whole big project. And it literally broke before the end of the day. And I thought, oh, no, what a shame. So we'll just have to do this. So, yeah, I went to a Salesforce event. They asked me to share my story and I was, you know, I drank the Kool-Aid. The other thing about Salesforce is, yes, I'd paid to do those first two training programs, but they have Trailhead, and Trailhead is definitely built for someone like me because when you finish a module, it spurts confetti at you. It just reinforces the goal-orientated person that I am, and, you know, you collect badges. Mm. But you actually collect really practical skills. You can get into a system and you can break it. So I love that Trailhead is free, that Trailhead is something that you can add to your resume for fun. And, you know, I loved to be able to say I'm at this tiny little organization with one person, but I can make this system work for me and I don't have to rely on another person if I don't have the budget.
I interviewed Hannah Andrevsky from Roundabout Canberra.
Yes.
And she too, I actually were writing a case study about her because I think it's for a small charity, unreal what they're doing with Salesforce with
yes.
the equivalent of two FTE.
Exactly.
It's really, really a powerful system if you know what you're doing.
Exactly.
But for you to go from, okay, not just the user of the system, but the administrator and now the designer. The enabler.
Yeah. And I got a random job, you know, when I was sort of in the space where, you know, cystic fibrosis was going through some changes. And again, I made a call and I said, you know, I can't work full time for this organization. We just don't have the budget. And I literally Googled Salesforce jobs and then went and did 3 days a week the implementation of Salesforce for the Australian Academy of Science. And it just opened my ICT project management world into a whole nother level because it was weird for me because I'd never thought about being in any industry other than the community sector because I love the ability to help people. But helping people connect to technology, It was a whole nother adrenaline rush. And to be able to do end-to-end, that business and system processing, that analysis, building a system that really works for a whole range of different people with different skills, and then training. I bring the golden hoodie out any chance I can. it really is something that is quite powerful, because I've never seen anything like it. And particularly what I love is there are so many people in internationally that don't have an IT background, don't know anything about IT, including myself, but can be experts in this.
I think Dynamics is a pretty powerful platform as well.
Yeah.
So for those who are in the Microsoft space, there are some other systems besides Salesforce, yes, that can provide very similar types of training as well as functionality. It's just a matter of getting competent enough to be able to use the tools, right?
And that's the thing. I think we're all stuck for time, but don't underestimate time investment.
Yeah.
So, you're never going to have enough time for everything that you want to do. But if you give yourself the opportunity to learn, then you work better. So I think that was the thing for me. And Salesforce did this great activity that was 100 badges in 100 days. So you had that accountability. You would post it on Twitter and say, this was the badge that I did today. You could do some of your badges because there were soft skills on your mobile. So I was literally in a hospital up on the patient Wi-Fi. And I was doing my badge every day. And sometimes I was just reading material and just keeping myself, up to date. And other times I, pulled a laptop out and was in a system trying to work it out. And that was really great for me because it actually gave my brain a distraction. It gave some really great learning, and then spits confetti. I'm like, oh, I'll just do one more badge.
Look, I want to talk more about your husband. Hmm? Your late husband, unfortunately, and one of your biggest projects lately was the Santa Speedo Shuffle.
Yes.
And you just had your 10th annual one last week. And we have to remind people that we are in winter here in Canberra.
We are in winter.
And last weekend it was -1 degrees Celsius,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
Please tell us about that particular project or event that you've run for the last 10 years and what you're doing with that.
Yeah, so certainly for the US listeners that you have, I poached that idea from Boston because they run at Christmas time in the snow around the block, finish at a pub and, raise quite a bit of money. So I had seen that event very early on in my fundraising career. And I thought, oh, that's awesome. I'd love to do something outrageous like that. And I actually took it to an organization and they said no. They said it's a little bit inappropriate.
Too risque.
Yeah. And I went, okay, fine. And when I was working in the public service, I did need a project. I think I went into the role quite burnt out. So I sort of had about 6 months of, probably 3 months of recovery. And then I was starting to go, I need to do something. So I actually went with my husband to a clinic, a hospital appointment that he had every 3 months for his entire life. And it was an opportunity for him to be in front of his medical team. So he didn't just have one specialist. He had a specialist for every part of his body that had to coordinate his care and continue to be on top of it and changing it and updating it and adjusting medications and, very complex multidisciplinary support. And we walked out of the hospital and he had a massive bag of medications that was, to last him till we came back in 3 months' time, and a list of things that he had to start doing. And I just said to him, who helps you do this? And he said, well, there's this little CF association in Canberra. I can apply for a bit of financial support, but pretty much I'm on my own. And my, fundraising community hat just went, rah, not okay. God, how do you do it? Like, you do this by yourself as well. And what's, quite commonly unknown about cystic fibrosis is, and, COVID will help us to understand this a bit better, but the CF community have their own versions of COVID that only people people with CF can pass between each other. So you can't have peer support groups. You don't even get hospitalized near each other. You are separated throughout the hospital. When you go to clinic, you go into your own room and they lock the door, and then, you know, your medical team is coming in fully in their PPE, and that is the life of a person with CF. And you know, we sort of thought, like, you're so isolated, you are going through something, but you have no way to connect with the rest of the community. And then you get this huge list of things to do, and the hospital are like, see you next quarter, and make sure you do what we've told you to do. So I said, oh, I've always wanted to do this event. And luckily Andy and I were just a bit of a dream team. He's like, yeah, let's do it. I said, oh, if you say yes to me, we're going with this. And so we literally spent the car ride back thinking, okay, what do we do and where are we going to go and what are we going to call it and all these sorts of things. And so I organized a house party and I invited a bunch of our friends. And I did get them drunk. And at the end of the night, I gave them a registration form and they all filled it out and were signed up to participate in this event. And again, different fundraising structure. So in the original model was there was no registration fee, but you had a minimum amount that you had to raise. So as an individual, you had to raise $550, and we just pulled that number out of nowhere. And you would get your uniform provided. And that again was my marketing and my brand background, because I went, I want to make this an annual event, so I need everyone to look good. You don't get to control your outfits. So the first year we had 9 Santas and we ran across Canberra and we raised $12,500.
Wow.
Yeah. And what we found was, you know, that was the first year, and then the second year more Santas came, but they all committed to that minimum amount. And the next year more Santas came, but they committed to that minimum amount. So we are, you know, we're so close to cracking the $1 million mark for 10 years. But most importantly, so this year we had 300 Santas join us, and I did change the model. This year I was like, just come and celebrate an incredible human. Let's fundraise as much as we can and you can choose your outfits, because I do not want to deal with the coordination of uniforms this year, particularly in a COVID supply timeline. But when I've actually looked at it, we have had only probably 300 different people over that 10 years. So it's been similar people coming back year on year on year on, fundraising that amount, and collectively we've made $1 million. And I think that's the thing that I have so much pride about, because particularly, you know, in those early years I was doing fun runs and you're going through so much effort to coordinate 250 people to do the City to Surf. And only like 7 of them actually fundraised, and they might have fundraised $65,000 and it was great. But I just sort of thought, I just really want a quality event where people commit again to the cause. And I guess you're seeing a bit of a theme in the way that I approach things. But also I guess I'm bold enough to ask people to actually show up.
In their Speedos, no less.
In their Speedos. And yeah, look, you know, I definitely rock the authentic Santa look. So, you know, I really, you know, I get out in my Speedos as well, but I always thought, probably a bit too confident in myself, but, I always thought Andy's life was hard. His CF was so difficult, but he got up every day and he did his medication and he did it every night before he went to bed. And when he was really unwell, he still did everything that was asked of him and he never complained. And I thought, I can get in Speedos, right? Like, you know, how could I not? How could I not for this person? Because it isn't hard. It was very cold, but it isn't hard. And, you know, I guess I'm lucky to have the perception that I do of myself, and, you know, a belief in myself that I can be beautiful in whatever I do and whoever I am. And I know that I'm very lucky to have that belief, but I also am lucky that Andy told me every day that I was beautiful inside and out. And I was like, well, why would he lie to me? Yeah. Like, it's obviously must be true. Yeah.
Well, you are a beautiful woman, speedo or not. Yes. And look, I think there's so many learnings from this conversation that we've had. And thank you for sharing those personal ones too. I think, you know, what a beautiful tribute to him and his memory as well to have the 10th event.
Yes.
And to raise so much money for this cause. What can our listeners do for you? How can they contact you and get involved in whether it's MEAT or anything else that you're working on right now?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think the big platform for me is LinkedIn. It's just really where I love to connect with people. And I love to hear what people are doing. And I guess a lot of people reach out to me to ask questions, to even run stuff by me. And I guess I'm always about helping. So my thought would be, you know, just let's connect. You'll always hear me doing something really random and just like get on board and get behind it or share it or tell somebody about it. Because I think that we think that, you know, maybe the only way that we can run is if we donate or if we participate, but we also just need to share the message. So I would always say to people, let's just connect, because who knows where this could go. And, you know, I'm always trying to do more for my community. I've got, you know, some things that I'm thinking of. What's my project going to be next year? And I've got another idea that I'm stealing from the US that I look forward to letting everyone know about. But I guess it's just, you know, there is a lot of need in our world. So not for me, just look for a way that you can give back and consider what that gift could look like. And I think a lot of the time we underestimate how much not-for-profits could benefit from skills. And I actually have the perfect example. I had a professional friend, a great human, message me last weekend or the weekend before the Santa Shuffle and said, I would really like to help you on the day if I can. These are the things that I'm good at. And I thought, you are the best human that I've ever met, because we always say, what can I do to help? Or is there anything that I can do to help? And for someone who's been a carer, I just think I can't process what I need you to do. That's too hard. So thank you, but I probably will never ask you. The best people in, you know, my entire time as a carer and professionally have been, I would like to help you. This is what I can do. And I just immediately went, oh, yeah, could you run social media for the day? That just takes one thing off my head and I don't have to think about it and I don't have to get to the end of the day and realize that we've not posted anything because I've been too busy, you know, doing other stuff. And I had another friend who did the same thing. I said, great, you'll coordinate the day. And I got to show up and participate. I mean, I did all the organizing in the lead up, which is I wanted the control over that. I needed to do that. But on the day, I needed to be there and I needed to participate and I needed to be able to get around to the people that attended and thank them for being there. And I needed to be able to walk it. And I jogged the very last part, but I crossed the finish line and I really had not anticipated the arrow that just went through me, because it was, again, an ending. And I couldn't have had that experience that I needed if I hadn't have had these people say, I would like to help you and these are the things that I'm good at or what I can do or, you know, things that I love or what I'd like to help with, you know, offer and be practical.
Like some beautiful stories. It makes me a little bit emotional hearing about this, I'm sure for you as well. Just also, you know, if for the listeners that have heard this story, I think there's something there to say that if you're going to ask to help, then, you know, say what you can do. Actually be legit and not just do it to be nice, but to say I'm good at the following things. I think everybody, including myself, should do that more often. So thank you for sharing that. Heidi, it's been a great opportunity to get to know you better. You've provided some really great ideas around fundraising in particular. And thank you for sharing your personal story too. The work that you and your team are doing is just incredible, and I'm sure our listeners have definitely benefited from this conversation. So Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcast, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT and Plain English segment is, what is a data strategy? There are many, many definitions for a data strategy, but the simplest explanation is that it's basically a plan for how you'll use the data you've collected for specific outcomes. These outcomes might be to generate more revenue or to provide a better experience for your members or clients. It may also be to support strategic decisions, such as deciding what products and services you may want to offer and where, or perhaps to reduce cost or report the outcomes for a grant. Regardless of your goals for your data, it's important to treat it like a proper asset. This includes everything you would typically do to protect a physical asset, like a new car. If you had a new car, you'd want to store it safely. You'd only want certain people to have access to it. And you'd maintain and clean it periodically to ensure that it continues to meet your needs. And how you do these things are part of a data strategy, including any technology you may need to implement this plan. So there you have it in plain English. If you have an IT question you want answered, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you've liked what you've heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all of you executives with the cause, the world is definitely a better place because of you. Thank you for what you and your teams do every day.